America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. The anti-science sentiment sweeping the world and finding a very comfortable home in America is startling to many of us, particularly when you let the learned experience of our guest on this episode seep in as he explains that vaccines are perhaps the greatest achievement of mankind, saving literally hundreds of millions of lives in modern history. So why the hesitancy about the COVID-19 vaccine and the general trend to resist taking vaccines of all types? It's been growing since 2015. It's a trend that doctors, political leaders, and public health professionals must put an end to, or scourges of the past will revisit the world in a painful way. Our guest explains what medical and vaccine diplomacy can mean for the United States and all of the world. That's all today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Dr. Peter Hotez, and he's got a new book called Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. Now, for many of us, he has become a figure quite well known because he has been on major cable channels throughout the pandemic. He's a physician scientist. He is someone who we have seen comfortably in his office, bow-tied and always seeming to be there for us, the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and a professor at Baylor College of Medicine, where he also co-directs the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. I didn't know about your stint in the Middle East on behalf of the United States under the direction of President Obama. But that, of course, is a major reason for your interest in vaccine diplomacy. Explain your background a bit.
Yeah, so I'm a vaccine scientist and developing vaccines for global health, mostly neglected tropical diseases such as Chagas disease and schistosomiasis. And these are vaccines for the world's poorest people in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And, you know, one of the issues around it is there's not a commercial market. There's a big market in the sense of a lot of people get these diseases, but not so much a commercial market. So that involves a lot of international collaboration because no one organization has the resources to develop such vaccines. And early on, we began partnering with vaccine producers in Brazil and India, really across the world. And it occurred to me that this joint vaccine development had benefits beyond the actual vaccine that we were making in terms of building scientific collaborations and even foreign relations. And look to the legacy of Albert Sabin, who developed the oral polio vaccine. Not many people realize he did this jointly with the Soviets at the height of the Cold War, putting aside ideologies. And that's when the oral polio vaccine, even though the virus strains were first developed in Sabin's lab, it was actually tested on 10 million Soviet school children, shown to be safe and effective. And that's what led to ultimately the licensure of the polio vaccine. So the question is, how do we franchise something like that? Are there other opportunities? And so when President Obama, shortly after he was inaugurated, made this very important speech called the New Beginning Speech about reaching out to the Muslim world in the arts and sciences, he made that speech in Cairo, I said, you know, this is going to be a great example of pursuing vaccine diplomacy. And I was invited in 2015, 2016 to do just that, look at joint vaccine development for the Middle East and North Africa.
And it's really fascinating, that story in the book about the U.S. and the USSR. I had never heard it, and I don't think most of us in the United States understood that type of cooperation. I'm wondering, with vaccine diplomacy, as you see it going forward, what is the role for the United Nations or the World Health Organization? Are these going to be partnerships? Are there treaties involved, one-off understandings? What do you think best would represent a way for us to institutionalize a way to really help the rest of the world? Because we're seeing during this pandemic that we're doing rather well in terms of vaccination, but so many other parts of the world are not.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, of the billion or so doses of vaccine that's gone out, overwhelmingly it's in the Northern Hemisphere and maybe China. So leaving out Africa, Latin America, and poorer countries in South Asia. So we've got to fix this. And, you know, it's going to require a few things, but I think one of the cornerstones ultimately is going to be we have to look at how we can build capacity for vaccine development on the African continent. Currently, no vaccines are made in Africa, which is extraordinary. We've got to build up Latin America. There's, you know, Brazil and Cuba do some vaccine development, but it's modest given the need that we have to look at. And then in the Middle East, as well as elsewhere. And I think that's going to be a big step in vaccine diplomacy to build that capacity.
Now, we are told that, for example, there is a lot of manufacturing of vaccines going on in India, and yet during the pandemic and the point where we are at the moment, we've seen great distress and difficulty in getting the vaccine back for the Indian people. Explain what that sounds like and looks like to you.
So we're actually accelerating our vaccine in India. We have developed a low-cost recombinant protein, we sometimes call it people's vaccine for COVID-19, developed at our Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development at Baylor College of Medicine. And now we've transferred that technology to Biological E in Hyderabad, one of the big producers. And they're working furiously to try to scale it up. And they're not alone. So at the Serum Institute of India is accelerating the AstraZeneca vaccine. They're trying to produce it. Bharat, also in Hyderabad, is working to develop their own inactivated virus vaccine. And then there's another organization producing the Sputnik V, the Russian vaccine. And my response to that is we need to help India help itself. We need to give India all of the raw materials and supplies they need to rapidly accelerate vaccine production, because the scope of the problem is enormous. You know, India has over a billion people, of course. They'll likely have to immunize 800 million people in India. And if most of the vaccines are two doses, you're talking about 1.6, 1.7 billion doses of vaccines. And the current approach isn't working. Yes, the Biden administration announced they'll provide 20 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. But, you know, what is 20 million doses when you need 1.6 billion? 20 million doses is enough for, you know, a few suburbs around Delhi. It's just not meeting the demand and the capacity. And we have the other problem of the domino effect, which is India not only has to provide vaccines for itself, but the whole infrastructure on health, on vaccine equity for COVID-19 depends on India providing vaccines for Africa and for Latin America. And now there's a domino effect because the Modi government has asked them not to ship vaccines out, to keep it within India. So this is a crisis situation right now.
It's so interesting that we are talking about vaccines. It's your specialty. And in the United States, this movement of anti-vaccine, and it's throughout the world, nationalism, as you point out in the book, is one of the contributors. And when I read your book, and I read that vaccines have saved hundreds of millions of lives, and you consider it to have surpassed all other biotechnical developments in terms of impact on public health, and here we are, in the second decade or third decade of the 21st century, and all of this reluctance going on, I know as a non-scientist, it amazes me. It daunts me. It frustrates me. It's got to be just mind-bending to you.
Well, it is, and it's very personal for me because I have four adult kids, and Rachel is my youngest daughter, and she has autism and intellectual disabilities. And a few years ago, I wrote a book, another book called Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, to debunk all the fake assertions from the anti-vaccine movement about linking vaccines and autism. And that made me public enemy number one with anti-vaccine groups. In fact, they've got a name for me now. They call me the OG villain, which I have to look up. It means the original gangster villain. So you're interviewing the original gangster villain today. And that has prepared me for what's happening with COVID-19, because having that front seat to all of this, I've been able to see what's happening. And now, you know, what was fringe group has now become its own anti-vaccine, anti-science empire. Those same anti-vaccine groups now, according to the Center for Countering Digital Hate, have 58 million followers, if you can believe it. And that they're not alone. They now have state actors involved. So we have the Russian government, and this has been reported by U.S. and British intelligence and analytics groups, that the Putin government has lobbed this whole program of weaponized health communication to specifically discredit westernized COVID vaccines in favor of Sputnik V. And now we also have this, the fact that under the guise of health freedom, medical freedom, you know, the anti-vaccine group had pivoted to the extreme elements of the Republican Party, the Republican Tea Party down here in Texas and Oklahoma about 6-7 years ago, and now it's become mainstream across the Republican Party. And we have four news polls from PBS NewsHour, from Kaiser Family Foundation, from Quinnipiac, from Monmouth University, that Republicans are now the single most vaccine-hesitant group. Up to half of Republicans are now saying they won't get vaccinated. So that's going to prevent us from achieving our goals of interrupting virus transmission. So this is a problem, and we've really failed to address that, and we have to recognize it now for that anti-science is a potent force, and it's a killer.
I remember the book that came out that talked about autism as a contributor of the vaccine itself, and that was debunked, mercury and such. But what is it now? Because you tell us that you benchmark 2015 as the year when infectious and tropical diseases began their new ascent in relation to anti-vax, in relation to political instability. And we will get into that, because I don't think people tie a lot of political science to regular science, but you do it so well in your book.
Well, thanks. Yeah, in fact, I actually wrote the book, wrote most of the book prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, to make the statement that we were already seeing an unraveling of global health because of anti-science forces, and not only anti-science forces, other social determinants as well, such as war and political collapse and urbanization, also climate change is an important feature, and how they interact in unique and interesting ways in certain parts of the world, such as the Arabian Peninsula and Venezuela, and even here in Texas.
So tell us, as we look at this, what is it that we need to do to get a message back on track, if vaccines indeed can lead us to a lot of world peace, perhaps, a world less discomfort? Then what can we do? Because we've seen the tremendous developments, and you point them out in the book in terms of being able to eradicate smallpox, polio, almost, measles declined by 90%, meningitis basically gone. I mean, those are so in your face facts about the world that we live in, that in many cases we've forgotten all that. We don't really think about it very much, thankfully, because of the science. So how has this anti-vax movement crept back in such a powerful way?
Yeah, I mean, we have to rebuild vaccine capacity, and we have to make it possible to produce vaccines on the African continent, expand what we do in Latin America, and we need to launch a counteroffensive against the anti-vaccine movement. I've recently written an article in Nature that says the old approach of pretending it's not there and saying if we talk about it, we'll give it oxygen, you know, that worked before something called the internet came along. And now we have to recognize that it's a very potent force and create a UNH interagency task force at the United Nations or in the Biden administration to look at all the different aspects that we're seeing, including these dedicated anti-vaccine groups that have 58 million followers and dealing with the Russian government, dealing with this very disturbing rise of anti-vaccine activities in the Republican Party. It never used to be that way. I mean, there were, you know, let's face it, Abraham Lincoln started the National Academy of Science. Eisenhower started NASA and George W. Bush launched PEPFAR. I mean, anti-science was never a component of the Republican Party, and we have to find a way to tear the anti-science out of it. And it's, you know, for us, it's for scientists, it's very uncomfortable. We don't like talking about politics. We're not good at it. And it's not that we're becoming political, but there's no other, I found no other way to do it other to tear the anti-science out of this other than by calling it out, because otherwise people don't understand what you're talking about.
I just read where there are bills being put in place, at least offered in 40 states. That are basically anti-vax, 40 American states in 2021. It is pretty remarkable stuff. It really is. But I want to get back to the vaccine diplomacy and the whole notion that there is so much at play in the world that requires more of it, not less of it. And help us to understand, those of us on the outside, how political instability, we'll take number one because you give us four areas where, in fact, it's so important, but political instability and the impact that that has, for example, on measles and malaria making a comeback.
Well, you know, what we're seeing, measles is one of the most infectious diseases we know about. And the minute you start seeing declines in vaccine coverage, that's often the first disease that you see come back. It's kind of the sentinel disease that, you know, there's a problem. And now we've seen measles come back to the U.S. in a big way in 2019 with 1,200 measles cases. This is 19 years after we first eliminated measles in the country in 2000. So, and it's not only the United States. We're seeing massive measles epidemics in Madagascar and in Samoa and in Europe. So much so that in 2019, the World Health Organization declared vaccine hesitancy as one of the top 10 global health threats. And now I think we can see this fully playing out. And it's because we haven't been willing to take this on. In the case of malaria, what you're seeing is, or schistosomiasis, another parasitic disease, you're starting to see it pop up in places where we really haven't, where we thought we had it under control. So it's come roaring back to Venezuela. With the collapse of the Maduro regime and the socioeconomic collapse linked to that, not so much the collapse of the Maduro regime, but the socioeconomic collapse in the Maduro regime has caused people to seek employment working in the illegal gold mining industry, and they're sleeping outside without mosquito nests and seeing this massive return of malaria. You're seeing malaria return to Greece, possibly because of economic declines there and slowing of vector control together with climate change. So, you know, we're under kind of slowing, halting, or even reversing a lot of our public health gains in the last two decades because of these social forces.
And, of course, you point out that political instability affects the sanctity of a health system. It gets toppled along with other institutions, and that is so apparent in Central America, the wars in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen with cholera. The other area, another area that you point to, is internal displacement and human migrations. And people tell us that given climate change, even within the Northern American hemisphere, we're going to see a lot more displacement in the coming period.
And look what's happened in Venezuela now. You know, people fleeing the political instability and economic collapse. So they go into the rainforested areas of the Brazilian border where they come into contact with Yanomami indigenous people, and they're getting really hit hard from measles right now, almost like when measles affected Native American populations, First Nations people in the United States in Canada during European colonization hundreds of years ago. So we're seeing that play out, and also in the Wayuu indigenous people on the Colombia-Venezuela border. So indigenous people are getting hit very hard because of these human migrations, or people fleeing the conflict zones of Syria and Iraq, going into refugee camps into Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, and we're seeing the spread of leishmaniasis, which is a vector-borne parasitic disease.
You also describe the issue of urbanization, where people are really crowded into these large cities. Anybody who's watched the news recently and sees what's going on in Delhi, India, as an example, and populations have outstripped the infrastructure, so that's another contributing factor.
Well, how do you do social distancing in the crowded urban slums of Delhi or Mumbai? And you can't, and this is one of the and hospital systems get quickly overwhelmed. And imagine what happens when COVID-19 goes into the mega cities like Kinshasa or in the Democratic Republic of Congo or in Lagos in Nigeria. You know, if you look at the demography, the world is slowly coalescing into giant urban mega cities of 10, 20 million people or more. And if we don't have the infrastructure to keep up with it, these are going to be the new hotspot areas of disease. You know, 50, 100 years ago, there were a few megacities like Tokyo, London, and New York. And now all the megacities are cities like Sao Paulo or Rio de Janeiro or Kinshasa or Lagos or Mumbai or Dhaka. And we can expect that disease and illness is going to really take off in these places because urbanization and climate is not the only issue. We also have climate change happening. So these are become hot, sweltering megacities as well. So it all compounds.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Peter Hotez, Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science, and we've been going over the unraveling since 2015 of this attempt to keep the world safe by using vaccines and other medical interventions. And of course, we talked about the political instability issue, internal displacement, urbanization, and then we get back to anti-science and nationalism. You say about nationalism in the book, it's a powerful statement itself. Nationalism has become a social determinant of disease.
Yeah, that's right. Because what you're seeing now is, you know, people defining their allegiance by being defiant of public health interventions. And we've seen this playing out in the United States now, where defiance of masks and social distancing and vaccines becomes a badge. And we're also seeing this play out in other places as well. So this kind of national populism that we first saw during the time of Donald Trump is now playing out in Brazil under Bolsonaro, or in the Philippines under Duterte, or in Nicaragua under Daniel Ortega, or you know, in some extent, and playing out in Tanzania as well. So this is yet another really important force that we have to look at. I think the other interesting aspect is, you know, as physician scientists, guess what I never got training in? urbanization, nationalism, anti-science, political instability, poverty. And so another side theme of the book is, you know, maybe we have to revisit how we're training our docs and training our scientists to broadly educate them to know how to manage these kinds of very complicated issues. And so, you know, for instance, when I talk about, you know, the rise of anti-vaccine, anti-science activities in the Republican Party, how do you do that? How do you do that respectfully? How do you do that in a way that doesn't make it seem like you're biased politically, but you need to talk about it in order to save lives?
Well, you tell us that the World Health Organization put out a global alert just a couple of years back about measles, kids not getting shots. And then, of course, measles has been reestablished, and there's a foothold across North America and Europe. So I don't think we really caught up to that. We saw these outbreaks in portions of New York with the Orthodox Jewish community and some other areas, but I don't think the American public really took that too seriously, because we thought, well, these were religious exemptions that were at play. And then, of course, when all the warp speed operation took place and we came up with some miraculously quick, cures, or not cures, but interventions, and yet we're still reluctant to take them. What is it about the American public and our sense of independence or personal liberty that may be striking a real blow to public health?
Well, we have seen these ebbs and flows of health freedom, medical freedom since the early 1800s, in the time of Andrew Jackson. But the difference now is it's really accelerated by groups that wish us harm, and the bandwidth of the internet. And I think that has a lot to do with it as well. And now it's become, what was a fringe group has now become a killer. And remember, this is not just, American exceptionalism. This is deliberate disinformation coming from groups that want to inflict damage, from anti-vaccine groups, now with 58 million followers, or the Russian government under Putin, and now this sort of mainstreaming across the conservative element of the country, which is going to prevent us from fully vaccinating the U.S. population against COVID-19.
Yeah, where are we in that? I mean, we will be posting this podcast a little bit down the road, but we are in the midst of trying to get these vaccinations into everybody's arms. And yet we now find that there's probably about a rate of 25% reluctant people who we're going to have to drag out of the house. What impact does that have on herd immunity ultimately?
Well, remember, it's not just 25%, because it's 25% on top of 20%. We have 20% of the U.S. population cannot get vaccinated because they're under the age of 12. So that's where you start seeing a problem. And again, if you look at the vaccination rate, the polls say it's, the Republicans are the single most vaccine hesitant group. All you need to do is look at the top 10 states for vaccine coverage and the bottom 10 states for vaccine coverage. The top 10 states for vaccine coverage are New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, California, New Mexico, all blue states. The bottom states are, guess what, Wyoming, Idaho, Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, and Louisiana. So we know where this is headed. The default right now is going to be a blue state, red state divide, in which the blue states could become close to fully vaccinating and reducing transmission. I don't even like using the term herd immunity anymore, because it's been so corrupted by right-wing extremist groups. So what I do say is, we are going to potentially interrupt transmission in the states that achieve high vaccination coverage, like the blue states I just mentioned, leaving the red states with a significant level of virus transmission. And that's not a situation anybody wants, because it doesn't work that way. It's going to continue to allow the virus to circulate and mutate and allow variants to emerge.
What about the differential among the world communities? Will we be able to travel again for a long period of time? We don't know exactly how long.
I think by the summer, sure, we can travel domestically. We can travel to Canada. We can travel to other countries that are well vaccinated, like Israel and the United Kingdom and a few Western European countries. But that's about it. So, if you can't do business with Nigeria and Africa, if you can't do business in Latin America or the Middle East or parts of Asia, that's a problem. And so what it means is our economic recovery will begin, and so we'll start to accelerate in the next few months. But then it's going to plateau prematurely, because you can't really operate a global economy with
six or seven functioning countries.
In closing, let me ask you about the importance of medical diplomacy, because you're a great advocate of it. We've seen where America has gone awry in terms of trying to control events around the world and using our military. But you point to another opportunity for America, using our research universities, our institutes ranking among our national treasures, and providing an important face for our nation. Do we undervalue that? In other words, can we start using this vaccine diplomacy, medical diplomacy, as a real tool to reestablish America on the world stage?
Yeah, I mean, I think science diplomacy is terribly underused in the United States and yet very powerful. I mean, in my time as U.S. science envoy in the Middle East and North Africa, you know, everybody, you know, that I would meet in government had trained in U.S. universities and in science, but not necessarily just the MITs and Stanfords of the world, but, you know, they were in University of Iowa and Iowa State University and University of Oklahoma and University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You know, our big land-grant universities are such national treasures. We're training leaders across the world, and I don't think we capitalize on that. I think there's a great opportunity here to give a different face to the country around our great universities.
Well, you've been a great ambassador, helping a lot of us through the pandemic. Dr. Hotez, the book, Preventing the Next Pandemic. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our audience? I think a well-educated group, but is there anything that you'd like to share with us that we haven't discussed today?
No, I think we did. You know, we covered a lot of important topics, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book.
Well, it's been a great honor, really, to have you on with us. And I thank you, and I wish you the best of health, and continue speaking out loudly. Your voice is very important.
Well, thank you for giving attention to this.